5 days, 6 minutes, our Friday regulars, of course. Jobs also, of course. I mean, come on. And we will do a little stargazing to wrap things up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 9th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A little bit of everything this week with which to fill the first six and a half minutes of this show. Some politics, maybe the bond market, tax policy, probably also the Delta variant, oh, by the way. So let's go. Sudeep Reddy is at Political. Kate Davidson is at The Wall Street Journal. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you and this executive order omnibus that the president issued today. 72 items, lots of it in there. We're going to talk about one specific thing later in the program. But I do want to set aside for a second the fact that he threw everything but the kitchen sink in there and point out that he's really trying to rebalance the economy here from corporations to consumers.
He is indeed. I would have expected that we might take 72 days to roll these out. Maybe the messaging strategy would have consumed August with this. But they really seem intent on coming out with the big bang approach and showing that this is collectively a lot of small steps. But the larger message is the shift in power, trying to move the power in the economy away from employers having the power to workers having the power. And you've seen that in other ways as well. The way President Biden has kind of just like shrugged off the worker shortage that mm-hmm. businesses are complaining about. He said, well, just like pay him more. And his staff is behind this as well. Just like this is the chance for workers to command more pay and more benefits and more ability to negotiate. Yeah. And so that's what's happening. It might be brief. I don't know that this is going to last for all that long, but these are all steps, and some of them will be for consumers as well. Many of these 72 could really shape slowly how we do things.
I chuckled, but he did, in fact, at one point say, just pay him more, and that'll take care of it. Kate, let me ask you this, though. These are executive orders, or it is an executive order. It's not a law, and as we've seen, as we go ping-ponging from administration to administration, a stroke of a pen, and it's an undone deal.
That's right. And it also takes a long time to implement these. Well, I should say it's unclear how long it would take, right? I mean, that's a big unknown, is how hard and how fast all the various agencies that are involved in this, you know, will adopt new rules and regulations. And then that is really likely to set up showdowns with, you know, U.S. businesses. Then that could take a long time to resolve. So, right, it's easy, you know, it's an easy stroke of the pen, but it's all the work after that. And then, as you said, it's not as lasting, of course. Is something that's enacted into law.
Sudeep, I want to do the bond market for a second and inflation all in the same breath. Neil Irwin in the New York Times had a piece on this week, but those who watch the bond market have been commenting as well that the bond market, a predictor of inflation and where growth in this economy is going, does not seem to be thinking inflation's going to be a thing. Yields on the 10-year, as we talk about every day on this program, are actually falling. Help. What is going on?
Yeah, you know, there are times when the bond market is screaming and telling you there's a problem in the economy. We actually saw it at the start of last year before the stock market reacted to the pandemic. We saw it at other points in recent years. And you have to take those seriously because they can be useful signs. Bond traders do understand some of those. There are other factors going on here, though, that led to this giant plunge in bond yields. And it's the global order that we're dealing with. There's so many forces globally that point to maybe we're not going to have this the 1920s style boom repeating in the 2020s. Maybe there are other problems underneath, and some of them come from the Delta variant. Some of them are more structural, but it's clear that the level of excitement people have about the economy, at least globally, needs to be tamped down just a little bit.
And I'll just point out here for those keeping track on their calendars, next week we get consumer prices, the consumer price index. So it'll be another look at inflation. Kate, let me take you to Secretary Yellen. I have here written in my notes AMT, alternative minimum tax, but that's not really what she's working on. She's working on a global minimum tax. She's getting a lot of countries lined up behind her. But she does also have to get 535 members of the Congress of the United States, or at least majorities in the houses. to agree to this. And I think that's maybe the bigger challenge.
It would seem. I mean, I talked to a number of folks a couple weeks ago. I was trying to line up some reporting ahead of her trip to Venice. And some of them were really doubtful that she could get even the G20 countries behind this. And then the Thursday before her trip to Venice, the OECD yeah. comes out and says, hey, we have 130 countries. It was pretty surprising. And from what we can tell, she managed to break this impasse. The talks had kind of stalled at the end of the Trump administration. So it's you know, to her credit, they got to this point where there's the broad contours of an agreement. But right, every country now has to, first of all, they have to work out the details of an implementation plan. Where are they going to set the tax rate? But they all have to go back to their legislatures. And I think, you know, of all those countries, the eyes are really on the U.S. Congress. And are mm-hmm. they going to agree to these changes? You know, they're not, an international agreement doesn't mean much, you know, unless it becomes a law. You know, you can't really enforce it. So right, you have Republicans who are generally not that crazy about this idea of a global minimum tax. But for the Biden administration, it's really a key piece of their overall agenda. They want to raise corporate tax rates here. And if you raise them a lot here and other countries don't raise them, you have a problem, right? There's an incentive for businesses to leave. And so that's why it's so important. So it's a really big test for her to see how they can advance this piece of the agreement that they work so hard to get the rest of the world on board with.
Yeah. And she is spending a whole lot of time on this. Sudeep, real quick, we got 45 seconds. I mentioned this yesterday, but just because it's going to keep on coming up, the debt limit is rearing its ugly head again. And there are now reports that the virus is going to make it really tricky to figure out exactly when we're going to hit that debt limit. And oh, by the way, now you got 30 seconds.
Yeah, throw all these things together and then you get the cocktail of trouble. Look, we're actually, I think, just weeks away from hitting the 10-year anniversary of the debt downgrade of the United States. And we have learned something in the past decade. There's going to be a lot of crying going on, a lot of screaming leading into it. But generally, we seem to be able to plow through these after getting through that momentary tantrum. So hopefully it'll just be a tantrum this time again.
We do have to do the dance. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, up at the open, up all day, up at the close. Funny how that works, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were talking about this yesterday, how the unemployment situation varies state by state across this economy. And as it does, by the way, in normal times, variations that are just bigger now in virus times. Anyway, 26 states have now cut off at least some of the federal unemployment benefits that were in all those various relief packages, benefits that were funded to run through the end of September. The states that have ended those benefits, 25 with Republican governors, one with a Democrat, say the checks are keeping people from going back to work. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, a series of recent lawsuits argue that governors don't have the authority to not take the money.
When the National Unemployment Insurance System was established during the New Deal era, states were given control over their own programs, says Chris O'Leary with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research.
Essentially, a federal state system was established. It wasn't forced on states.
They can decide on everything from eligibility requirements to the level of benefits. But this week, a judge in Maryland ordered the state to hold off on cutting federal benefits as a lawsuit moves forward. It's being led by attorney Alex Summerfield for the Unemployed Workers Union. He points to language in the law that created Maryland's unemployment system.
The whole point of unemployment insurance is to combat involuntary unemployment, and that unemployment itself is a menace. They literally use the word menace to a morals, welfare, and safety of the community.
So the law directs the state to cooperate with the federal government.
Cutting these benefits 2 months early does not fulfill the state's responsibility to combat unemployment.
In Ohio, Mark Dan, the former state attorney general, filed a similar suit earlier this week, claiming that state law there also directs the governor to maximize unemployment benefits.
our law in Ohio was passed in 1936, right at the height of the Great Depression. And so I think it was really important at that time for the legislature to make sure that people wouldn't play politics with unemployment benefits.
And that's the case for many states, says Andrew Stettner with the Century Foundation.
A lot of the laws are kind of similar because they were developed and around the same time with the same guidance.
Suits in Texas and Indiana are following a similar path, but they could face tough barriers. The Federal CARES Act, which created enhanced unemployment benefits, specifically allowed states to opt out. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Those green driving announcements have been coming fast and furious of late. See what I did there? Fast and furious. You got Tesla all the time, GM a couple of weeks ago, Ford with its electric F-150. This week, it was Stellantis, the merged car company formerly known as Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot, with its plan to get in the electric vehicle fast lane. $35.5 billion by 2025. 5 new battery factories in North America and Europe. By 2030, all 14 of its brands, Jeep, Dodge, Opel, and Alfa Romeo among them, are going to be offering electric models. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has a glimpse of our EV future.
Stellantis is trying to catch up with its rivals with its ambitious electrification plans. Kristen Gicek at the Center for Automotive Research says the global industry is clearly transitioning to a new electric future.
The stars are kind of aligned. So we've got, you know, the technology is getting better and more capable.
Especially batteries, getting cheaper and lasting longer. Stellantis aims to boost its EV sales to 70% of total sales in Europe, where there are strict emissions regulations and driving distances tend to be short. But in the U.S., there are some big hurdles in the way of Stellantis even hitting 40% in the next decade. And the same is true of GM, Ford, and the others. Lack of vehicle charging infrastructure, for starters, says Garrett Nelson at CFRA Research.
Currently, there are about 43,000 charging stations in the U.S. 30% of those are in California. And there's huge swaths in the country with very few charging stations.
And even if EVs can eventually be driven and charged all across America, it's not clear Americans everywhere will want them, says Kristen Gicek.
The big question in all of this is, are mass market consumers really there? If it's more expensive, it's harder to use, and it doesn't fit your kids' hockey equipment, there is no reason for that kind of a consumer to get into an electric vehicle.
So marketing will be key, says Nick Shields at investment research firm Third Bridge.
There is some of that, like polar bears and you're going to save the planet in some marketing material. But I think the more important thing is, you know, hey, this is an electric car and it's just as cool and does just as much stuff as your internal combustion engine.
Shield says the big challenge for Stellantis will be convincing loyal Jeep and Ram customers that it's time to try one out. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you miss us on the air for whatever reason, we don't care why, you can always get us on our podcast, your platform of choice, or marketplace.org if you like. Coming up.
It's not going to happen by enforcing an ordinance.
Sometimes, though, laws do work, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 448 today, 1.3%, closed at 34,870. The NASDAQ added 142 points, nearly 1%, 14,701. S&P 500 packed on 48 points, 1.1%, 43.69. For the week, the Dow added 0.2%, the NASDAQ up 0.4%, S&P 500 up 0.3%. Banks go down, banks go up. They were among those leading the market rebound today. Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and JP Morgan Chase all up more than 3% today. Here is how some publicly traded hearing aid manufacturers fared today. You will find out why in just a second that I am bringing this up. Intracon, Corporation of Arden Hills, Minnesota, up 4.8% today. Knowles Corporation over in Itasca, Illinois, gained 1.4%. Eargo of San Jose, California, up the coast, declined 2.6%. on this Friday. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note. Sadiq and I were talking about this, up to 1.35%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You roll 72 big issues into one executive order. There's a whole lot of stuff that gets lost in the shuffle. We talked about some of the big ideas up at the top, Sadiq and Kate and I, but the Biden administration is also taking aim at least one very small thing that a lot of Americans rely on. Physically small, perhaps, but socially and psychologically huge, hearing aids. According to the White House, just 14% of the 48 million Americans who have hearing loss use hearing aids, partly because they are so expensive. So Marketplace's Amy Scott explains what the Biden administration's planning to do about that.
Dominic Corriveau has struggled with hearing loss since he was a kid, but couldn't afford hearing aids. By the time he was 30, it was affecting his performance at work.
The joke was I was always sitting in the front and I'd be like, oh yeah, because I'm a real go-getter. But it was really because I wanted to hear what was going on.
Finally, his employer bought him a pair.
I believe it got me into more rooms, into more meetings, and was invited to more stuff. What I realized was there was so much that I missed.
Untreated hearing loss can lead to depression and accelerate cognitive decline. But most insurance doesn't cover hearing aids, and the average cost is more than $5,000 for a pair. Kate Carr is president of the Hearing Industries Association. She says that cost isn't just for the device.
You're buying the services of that professional, your test, your screening, your fitting, the follow-up.
But the Biden administration says people with mild to moderate hearing loss don't need all those services, and over-the-counter sales could open up competition. Right now, just four companies control almost 85% of the market. Congress had already passed a law allowing over-the-counter sales. Today's order asks regulators to issue the rules to make that happen within 120 days. Roberta Clark, emeritus professor at Boston University, says high-end audio company Bose just got approval for prescription-free hearing aids for $850 a pair.
That's a huge difference in price.
But it won't solve another challenge preventing some people from using them, stigma. And no president's stroke of the pen can fix that. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You're on a small business. There are a lot of things you got to be thinking about. Hiring, sales, bookkeeping, supply chains, and inventories. We have been checking in with Irene Kesselman the past year or so. She runs Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. And her dispatch for us today kind of hits on all of those notes.
I started hearing from companies stating that they were going to increase a portion of their line or their entire line in terms of realizing price increases. It started maybe I would receive one every other week, and now I am literally receiving letters weekly from a lot of the companies that I deal with. We are also seeing a lot of back orders. In the past, they might receive an order, and there might be two items off of that order that we have not received. However, we just started a new file folder because we can't, we have so many back orders. There's a lot more invoices. There's a lot more calls to be made to pay bills. You know, it's more time consuming for my staff to kind of match orders to packing slips, if you will, because we could receive 25 to 40 boxes in a day. And that is why I went back and hired a couple people, added a few more hours to the staff's, you know, weekly hours. And I will definitely be hiring additional staff if need be. But for now, I'd like to get my regular staff back to the hours that they had, which they're almost there. I don't know in 6 months, honestly, where we're going to be. The next 5 or 6 months should be very telling in terms of how the rest of the year plays out. It's forcing all of us to be very aware of how we price things and when I need to cancel orders as to make sure that I can sell through all the merchandise that I receive. I've been told by one or two sales reps that I should increase my buy by 50% in hopes that I get everything. But what if I do, and then the goods are produced miraculously, and I have to take in all those goods? So it's going to be really telling. And I go to market next week with my manager to buy for the holiday season, so I'm sure I'll learn a lot there.
Irene Kesselman, proprietor of Alley Cat Toys out of Carrboro, North Carolina. Out in West Texas, miles and miles and hours away from the bright lights of the big cities, the night skies are so dark that sometimes you can see the Milky Way just standing there in your backyard, but maybe not for too much longer. They are drilling for more oil out there every single year, and with the rigs and the development and the people comes light pollution. From Marfa Public Radio, Travis Bubenik's on that one.
There's an old song that's pretty well known here in the Lone Star State.
The stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas.
But these days, it's pretty hard for most Texans to see the stars. 85% of the state's population lives in rapidly growing urban areas. Bill Wren's one of the lucky few. He lives and works at McDonald Observatory, perched on a mountaintop in the state's rural Big Bend region, where the night skies are still pitch black, and the stars are about as bright as they come.
Yeah, we have to suffer through this, day after day.
About an hour away is the nation's largest oil field, the Permian Basin. And since oil drilling's a 24/7 business, astronomers here have grown increasingly concerned about all the lights on drilling rigs, trucks, and gas plants.
For the past 12 years or so, we have seen a gradually increasing glow that simply wasn't there in prior years.
Wren is a kind of dark skies salesperson for the observatory. He travels the oil field trying to convince companies to point their lights down or use different kinds of bulbs. He says it hasn't always been an easy sell.
First day I stepped foot on an oil rig, I was told you can't have too much light on an oil rig. It's a very dangerous environment.
Safety is a key concern, says local oil field foreman Caleb Taylor.
The lighting we have is big halogen sodium lights, and they point them in all directions to pretty much cover the whole pad.
Wren's pitch to industry is that brighter lights don't always mean safer lights.
What if that bright light is shining directly into your eyes, creating glare, and you can't see because of it?
Some oil and gas firms have embraced his message. At an Altus Midstream gas plant, facilities manager Austin Williams shows me the company's specialized lighting.
There's a small shield that kind of focuses the light beams to force their way downward instead of letting it spread and pan out.
Altus says there's no extra cost to designing facilities this way, but retrofitting old sites with new lights could be a different story. Oilfield foreman Caleb Taylor again.
There's hundreds of thousands of these light units that they would have to change, and nobody likes to do stuff that costs money. You know, like that's going to be a deterrent.
In Reeves County, one of the most active parts of the oil field, local officials recently adopted new rules requiring companies to update all their outdoor lights to tougher standards within 5 years, and to shield some lights within 6 months. The rules come with a possible $500 fine. Curtis Wilson, the county staffer in charge of enforcing the rules, says he'll go after companies if there's a complaint, but he says a lot of the compliance will be voluntary.
I don't expect that they will go into existing facilities and update them. They might. What I do expect is that the new constructed facilities will be shielded properly.
Hanging over these efforts to preserve dark skies is the fact that oil prices are higher than they've been in more than 2 years, and there's talk of even higher prices on the way. That could mean more drilling, more lights, and light pollution becoming less of a priority. Still, Bill Wren at the observatory says he thinks encouraging companies to play along is the best way to go.
It's going to happen by showing people that it's in their benefit. It's not going to happen by enforcing an ordinance.
And he says there's no real goalpost for reducing light pollution. Any little bit helps protect the observatory's research. In Marfa, Texas, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. Next week's big economic news, this week, it takes the form of the Federal Reserve's monetary policy report issued today and which Chair Jay Powell will take questions on from Congress twice next week, once from the House, once from the Senate, because you got to be fair, I guess. Two buzzwords to know, which you already know, inflation and transitory. I am not making any promises here, but if I can swing it, next week, we are going to keep this show a transitory and inflation-free zone, except for CPI next Tuesday. I'm taking a preemptive mulligan on that one. Wish me luck, would you? All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context. It is a little weedy, I grant you, but of note nonetheless. The New York Fed sent out its monthly snapshot of this economy this morning. Lots of wonky stuff in there, of course, but I thought this was interesting, which I guess makes me a wonk. I don't know. Gross domestic product in the first quarter. Remember, that's everything this economy produces. GDP was just 0.9% lower in Q1 this year than it was at the end of 2019, its most recent peak. So far, so good. But if we'd had all the growth we were supposed to have in the past 18 months, the economy would be 3% bigger than it is right now. BJ Lederman does our music. Nancy Fargali is the executive producer of this program. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend, all right? And oh, yeah. Wait. Oh, yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.